You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Moloa'a, K284AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will hear from master fermentation revivalist Sander Katz in a primer about the values and virtues of fermented foods. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors, Harvest Market, Kauai Marine and Mower, Anahola Stringed Instruments, and the Kauai Store.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostulas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Aloha and welcome to our double interview show here on In the Garden on the Farm. And first, we're going to hear from Sander Katz. He is the author of two books about fermentation, one called Wild Fermentation that was published back in 2003, and his latest, published in 2012, The Art of Fermentation, won the James Beard Award. He has presented workshops in over 15 countries and has his own YouTube channel. Please enjoy this half an hour interview with him.
Before we get into how to make sauerkraut and kimchi, I want to address a larger question. What is fermentation anyway, and why should we care about it? Broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. Typically, we use this word to describe foods and beverages that we intend to put in our mouths. But, you know, obviously, the transformative action of microorganisms is bigger than that. The transformative action of microorganisms is usually the reason why we reject food. It's why we throw food into the compost or into the garbage or decide.
I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, on the 14th floor of an apartment building on the Upper West Side. My dad had grown up in the Hudson Valley, so we spent a lot of time up at his family's land. My father always had a garden up in the Hudson Valley. So, I mean, I always was exposed to fresh food out of the garden and always had a clear understanding of, where vegetables come from, which I suppose not all city kids grow up with a clear understanding of. My path to fermentation was a very roundabout, circuitous path, and I would say that it began with my childhood taste for sour pickles and the sour flavors of fermented vegetables in particular. But I didn't grow up with a grandparent who had an annual fermentation practice or anything like that. I spent a couple of years in my 20s following a macrobiotic diet, and macrobiotics places quite a bit of emphasis on the digestive stimulation of live culture pickles. So that's when I began to be aware that there was a health benefit to these foods that I always had been drawn to. But even then, I wasn't making them myself, and it wasn't until I moved to Tennessee and started being involved in having a garden and was faced with the classic dilemma that all gardeners are faced with. All the radishes are ready at the same time, and all the cabbages are ready at the same time. I always had been a culinary explorer and enjoyed figuring out how to make things from scratch. So, you know, once I had a big stack of cabbages and was trying to figure out things to do with them, I remembered how much I loved sauerkraut, and I explored in cookbooks and figured out how to make sauerkraut. So that, you know, that began my exploration of fermentation. But, you know, really what you know, what put me on the path that I've been on of demystifying fermentation for people was when I was invited by some friends of mine to teach a sauerkraut making workshop at their family homestead. That was when I learned that in our culture there is a nearly universal fear of aging food outside of refrigeration, and that you know, almost everybody is terrified that they might accidentally make somebody sick, they might accidentally kill someone. So you know, that's when I realized that there was a hunger for this information and a lot of fear and a need for demystification. I was living in New York, and it was a time when I was looking to make a big change in my life, and I couldn't quite picture what that change was. And I just happened to be visiting a friend in New Orleans for Mardi Gras, and at a party a couple days before Mardi Gras, I met a couple of people who live at this community in Tennessee, and they regaled me with stories of life on their commune in Tennessee, and it seemed very intriguing. And I went down and visited a couple of times, and within a year, I had moved down there and decided that moving from the city to the country was the big change I was looking for. Sauerkraut was definitely my gateway drug into fermentation, and once I learned how to make sauerkraut and started thinking about what fermentation was and the idea of the transformative action of microorganisms, I just started experimenting with all sorts of realms of fermentation. I already had done some baking, and I started learning about baking with sourdough. Like many people in our region of the country, I started making what are called country wines, basically sugar wines flavored with all sorts of you know, flowers and fruits and vegetables and you know, anything edible, really. We have goats, so I started dabbling in cheese making and made yogurt and started learning about kefir. And then I met somebody who made miso, and I learned how to make miso. And so, you know, one thing led to another, and it just snowballed, and I kind of became the fermentation guy. Broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms, and there are different types of organisms involved in different ferments. You know, the broad categories would be bacteria and fungi. And among the fungi, you find yeasts, which are the most famous agents of fermentation, as well as various molds that are used in different ferments. So fermentation really covers, you know, quite a broad realm of activity. But what they all have in common is that it's the transformative action of microorganisms. Fermentation has really been central to many different culinary traditions. I would go so far as to argue that people could not have made the transition from hunter-gatherer lifestyles where on a daily basis people were concerned with the food that they would eat in that day to agricultural lifestyles where they put a lot of energy into crops that would be ready at particular moments of the year. If they did not have some insight into fermentation techniques and techniques for preserving the harvest. So, you know, I would say that agriculture would not be possible without some understanding of fermentation. Now, of course, you know, human beings did not invent fermentation. Fermentation is a natural phenomenon. You know, fermenting bacteria, you know, absolutely, you know, predate not only human beings, but all animals and all plants. So, you know, fermentation has always been part of the context for life. And, you know, there are many examples of, you know, animals other than humans, you know, enjoying the products of fermentation, stumbling upon fermenting fruits and such, and experiencing the fleeting pleasures of inebriation. But what's arguably unique to humans is that we learned how to harness that power and make it happen ourselves. We even use the same word, culture, to describe these little communities of bacteria that we transfer from one batch of yogurt into the next. And we use the same word to describe, not only our cultivation techniques, but, our language, literature, music, belief systems, scientific knowledge, and the totality of all things that people seek to pass on from generation to generation. In a number of ways, fermentation is very intrinsic to human cultures, and that, the story of human cultural evolution is very entwined with the history of various ferments. And the question of the origins of ferments is shrouded in mystery. They all are prehistoric. The earliest written texts in many different written traditions refer to existing ferments. These were, important parts of the cultures that, generated the texts and generated the earliest written records. My interest is helping people to reclaim fermentation as part of a larger project of reclaiming the food that we eat. Fermentation, like all aspects of food production, has always been part of the fabric of human communities. And it's only in the last couple of generations, as food production in general has disappeared into the realm of specialists and disappeared behind factory doors, that fermentation has largely disappeared from people's lives. And this is the reason why it's shrouded in so much mystery for people, because they don't see anybody doing it. And we live in this age of refrigeration, where there is tremendous suspicion and fear of any food that has sat outside of refrigeration. People who work in any kind of food service industry have to go through a training where they are told that it's dangerous for people to eat food that has sat outside of refrigeration for more than 4 hours. Well, that might be a reasonable guideline for people working in the food service industry to follow, but I would say, as a truth, it is a lie, because, if that were true, none of us would be sitting here. Our species would have perished thousands of years ago. People, because they are clever, observed under what conditions the transformative action of microorganisms could make foods more stable and more safe and more digestible and more delicious versus those conditions under which the foods would deteriorate and be rendered inedible or inappropriate for consumption. I got obsessed with botulism and have done a ton of research and reading, and there are no examples in the historical record anywhere, as far as I can find, of of botulism developing in fermented vegetables. This is a really, really safe food. Now, I don't want to encourage you to sort of go home and think that on the basis of what I've told you here, you can ferment meat. Meat is a whole different story, because interior flesh is sterile. And so meat gets cultured with whatever bacteria is on the knife, and there's much more randomness to it. And botulism, before the 19th century, when canning was invented, the food that botulism was known for, where the word botulism comes from, is from the Latin word for sausage. And it was so ground meat.
Primarily, I'm interested in helping to demystify these ancient rituals for people, helping people to understand that that these are things that they can do in their own kitchen. And then, certainly I think it's great to reinterpret these ancient arts and apply them in new ways or in new combinations or to new ingredients. It's not that I think we need to be wed to exactly the traditional way of doing everything. But I think that, the basics of fermentation, the parameters for safety and success success are very ancient, and they're not things that require a huge amount of technology, a degree in microbiology, the ability to identify specific microorganisms, the ability to have a completely sterile working environment, or any of those things. This is not rocket science. These are rituals that people have been doing for thousands of years.
You're listening to KKCR, and this is an interview with master fermentation revivalist Sander Katz.
For the most part, I would say that fermentation is as much art as it is science. And although these processes have been successfully industrialized, and they're done in factories by food scientists under sterile conditions, etc., they do not require highly exacting conditions or proportions. And I think that if you look at the highly varied traditions for any of the foods that have diffused through wide geographic areas. Take something like sauerkraut. It is interpreted in virtually infinite ways. There are lots of grandmas with secret recipes and secret spices that they put in, or their own sense of proportions. And if you look at communities where this is still alive, or this has been practiced for a long time, you can just find infinite variation. The kimchi in Korea, there's not a single style. There are regional styles, there are seasonal styles, and there are family secrets. So, all of these things have lots of room for individual creativity. People, introducing, special ingredients. People combining things in unique ways. People leaving out the salt altogether because they've been told that they need to avoid salt. There's lots of latitude for personal creativity, really, in all of the fermentation processes. Something that's interesting to me is that I think that fermentation is an interesting realm in which lots of different contemporary food movements are intersecting. So, for instance, if you are a locavore and you're seeking to, eat an exclusively local diet or a primarily local diet, and you live in a climate like here in Vermont, fermentation has to be part of the picture. It's how you have fresh vegetables to eat through the long winter. So, people who are interested in, reviving an emphasis on local foods are interested in fermentation. Lots of different nutritional movements come together in the realm of fermentation, because fermentation, augments the nutrients in food so well, makes food so much more digestible. There's a huge food recycling movement of, kids diving into dumpsters and trying to rescue discarded food resources. Well, if you're a dumpster diver, and you're finding, 50 pounds of turnips in the dumpster behind a supermarket, well, fermentation is the perfect thing to do with it. So I would say that fermentation is not, necessarily a food movement in and of itself, but rather an important realm of food in which lots of different food movements intersect. The actual dynamics of the microbial growth vary quite a bit depending on what the substrate is, the food that you're fermenting, and what the organism is. If we look at a food with a dense, complex nutrient, say protein, I think that one of the most vivid illustrations is the protein in soybeans. Soybeans have gotten a lot of attention because they are considered to be the vegetable food with the most concentrated protein. Well, unfortunately, our human digestive systems cannot extract that protein from the soybeans. So when we ferment the soybeans, and that is typically done with mold cultures, the molds basically break down the protein into amino acids that become much more accessible to our human digestive processes. So each ferment is a little bit different. In terms of the fermentation of milk, you have bacteria digesting the lactose and transforming it into lactic acid, which many people find easier to digest. So there is this important aspect of pre-digestion in ferments. Now, as far as a comparison to canning, canning is really the diametrical opposite of fermentation. In fermentation, we are cultivating the growth of microorganisms, and we're trying to guide which populations of microorganisms are growing, and to some degree to control the rate of growth of the microorganisms. But in canning, we are trying to completely prevent the growth of microorganisms by sterilizing the food, and that certainly has useful applications. Most ferments you can't store in your cellar for years, waiting for the apocalypse, whereas canned foods you can. But that convenience comes at a nutritional cost, because the sterilization is achieved by the application of high heat, and heat diminishes certain nutrients. So if you compared the vitamin C in canned sauerkraut to the vitamin C in fresh fermented live sauerkraut, you'd find that there's much higher level of vitamin C in the fresh live sauerkraut than in the canned product. Fermentation has many nutritional benefits. I've alluded a little bit to the benefit of pre-digestion. Fermentation actually augments nutrients by contributing additional B vitamins to foods, by contributing unique micronutrients. Fermentation can make foods more edible by detoxifying foods. But really, what I would consider to be the most profound nutritional benefit of fermented foods is the live cultures themselves. Not all fermented foods contain live cultures. Live culture foods would be a subset of fermented foods. For instance, breads typically do not have their live cultures intact because they've been in a hot oven baking. If you want to eat raw dough has live cultures. And even the foods that can have live cultures, like sauerkraut, often the commercial versions are pasteurized so that they won't be perishable, and they'll have a long shelf life and be able to be stored without refrigeration. But the significance of the live cultures is that they are really the same types of bacteria that we all have in our digestive system and that we all need in order to effectively digest our food, in order to assimilate nutrients, and they play a huge role in our immune function because they create a competitive situation which prevents potentially pathogenic bacteria from establishing themselves in our bodies. So if we are continually wiping out the bacteria in our intestines, then we are basically setting ourselves up to be microbial blank slates where the pathogens that we all inevitably encounter in the course of our lives have an easy time establishing themselves. Now, I would say that historically, nobody really had to think very hard about replenishing the bacteria in their intestines. But, we are living in extraordinary times, and, the influences of antibiotic drugs, not only that people elect to take as individuals, often for very important reasons, but there's the overuse of antibiotics is simply resulting in an accumulation of antibiotic chemicals in the water table. So, every time we drink water, we're ingesting low levels of antibiotics. The other thing we find in water from municipal tap systems is chlorine, which is put in there to kill bacteria. So there are all these factors in our contemporary lives, reflections of what I call the war on bacteria, which subject the bacteria in our digestive systems to more or less constant assault. And so for us living in the 21st century, more than for people ever before, it's become critical to consciously replenish the bacterial populations in our intestines. And one way people do this is with supplements called probiotics. But, you know, I think that the, you know, far better way to do it is with foods. And it just so happens that the live culture fermented foods are some of the most delicious, flavorful foods that people have ever figured out. Fermentation has been a way for farmers to add value to the products of agriculture. And really, it's been, you know, part of how farmers have been able to make farming an economically viable activity. So, you know, if you can take your cabbage and turn it into sauerkraut, it becomes considerably more valuable. If you can take your milk and turn it into cheese, it becomes considerably more valuable. If you can take your apples and turn it into hard cider, it becomes considerably more valuable. So I would say that the revival of fermentation is really important for making farming into an economically viable activity for small scale farmers. So that's another way that fermentation is important economically in this local food revival. So I have two different books. One is Wild Fermentation, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods, which focuses on fermentation and how to ferment lots of different foods yourself at home. And my second book is The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movements. And it was really a pretty direct progression from one to the other. After Wild Fermentation came out, I spent the better part of 2 years traveling around teaching fermentation workshops, talking to people about fermentation. And the people who I met who were interested in fermentation largely were people who were grassroots food activists of one stripe or another, people who were engaged in what I found to be really interesting projects, whether they were as straightforward as reviving local markets for food, reestablishing farmers markets, people starting CSAs and trying to figure out how fermentation might extend the season of their CSA farms, and many other types of food activism, some of which I wasn't particularly aware of. People who are trying to revive the important art of seed saving, to reclaim our seed stock, people who are involved in food recycling, people who are clean water activists. So anyway, I felt very inspired by, all this grassroots food activism that I encountered as I traveled around the country, and I felt inspired to write about it. So The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved is really the story of, grassroots food activist projects that I encountered as I traveled around talking about fermentation. We think of milk as a highly perishable food. Well, it turns out that, the idea of fresh milk is really a 20th century phenomenon. Throughout history, what people drank was soured milk. And so once the milk... The context in which I see my work in teaching people about fermentation and reviving fermentation is a much larger project of people reclaiming the food that they eat. In a nutshell, I would say that applying the principles of mass production to our food has been a huge failure. It is resulting in environmental destruction. It's resulting in a diminishment of our health. It is resulting in the destruction of any notion of economic security. And I think that it is critically important that people reclaim their food. Now, if you look at the big picture, in certain regards, things are very bleak. We see unprecedented concentration at every level of food production, distribution, etc. I mean, starting with the seed stock and the way that seed ownership has become concentrated, continuing through control of the major livestock markets, continuing through food retailing, where we have, you know, ever larger chain retailers who are dictating the terms to the farmers who are supplying them with food and are determining what choices consumers have. So in one regard, things are very bleak. What I find hopeful is that there is a rapidly growing, dramatic movement of people, you know, demanding organic food, demanding locally produced food, supporting local farmers, more and more people getting involved in local food production, either through the model of community-supported agriculture, you know, or just through small farming ventures. And so, you know, while so far that you know, that force for change, you know, is not, you know, toppling the big actors in the, you know, mass-produced food system. You know, I think that, you know, we really have to focus on how we can create change within our realms. And, you know, one thing I can say for certain is that, you know, sustainability is not a spectator sport. Sustainability is not something you can buy as a consumer. If we want to create sustainability, sustainability means participation, and people have to become participants in creating better food choices for themselves and for other people in their communities. And so, you know, I think we have to break out of this infantilizing role of consumer, and, you know, more of us have to, you know, take on creating food for ourselves and for other people. And I'm not preaching self-sufficiency, I'm preaching participation. And I think that, you know, there are lots of different ways that people can become, you know, participants in creating better food choices in their communities. And I think that, you know, thinking about, you know, changing the world is too big. It boggles the mind, and it just makes us feel disempowered. We have to, you know, we have to think about what we can do, you know, in the small realm in which we can have an impact. And we have to do it. And then, you know, that gives some structure to, you know, hope and positive action in our lives. And really each of us can make a difference. And food is an important, you know, realm in which we're all involved with several times every day. You know, through being involved in food production, you know, through helping to create better choices in our communities, you know, we can make a difference and, you know, start creating the better world that we want to be part of.
Thank you, Sander. Great interview. Next, we're going to listen to a talk by author Michael Pollan at the Bioneers Conference a few years ago called Beyond the Barcode. Michael is the author of 9 books, including one of my favorites, The Botany of Desire, and The Omnivore's Dilemma. His books, articles, and lectures are about the places where nature and culture intersect, like on our plates, in our farms and gardens, and in the built environment. His website, michaelpollan.com, is an excellent resource. Enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for that warm welcome, and thanks to Kenny, too. I don't know if you are aware of this. You're probably not. There's no reason you should know this. But the path that took me to my most recent book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, began in this room. So I've come here partly to repay a debt to Kenny. But much of my education in the hopes for transforming our food chain really owes to a pioneer, who many of you, I'm sure, have heard speak, and that's Joel Salatin. Everybody know who Joel Salatin is? Yeah? Whoa, I feel like mini-me. I'm not going to look at that. Anyway, anyway, when I was first writing about organic agriculture and the gradual industrialization of what had been organic agriculture, I spoke to Kenny, and he said, well, you really need to talk to one of the most important critics of organic agriculture, Joel Salatin. And I called him at Kenny's suggestion, first to get some salty quotes about Whole Foods and the organic empire, as he calls it. And I was hoping, I'd heard about this wonderful pastured chicken and grass-fed beef he was raising, and I hoped he would send me a chicken or a steak. Well, I got the salty quotes I was looking for. He went on about the clash of paradigms and the Western conquistador mentality that was ruining our food system, both organic and industrial. But when I asked him for a chicken, he said, sorry, I can't do that. I said, well, you're not set up for shipping. Well, I could have the FedEx man come with the dry ice and the box and the whole thing. And he says, no, you don't get it. I don't believe it's organic or sustainable to FedEx meat across the country. And if you want to try my meat, you've got to come down here to Swope, Virginia, which I promptly did. And thus began my education in one of the most interesting agricultures going on in this country. And I won't walk you through it. You've heard it from Joel. You can read about it in my book. But I just want to give you a little close-up vignette, because something I saw on that farm, and it may not have been something Joel focused on, was a real paradigm shift for me. And I think it holds the kernel of a completely different way of looking at our relationship to nature. Joel, as you know, calls himself a grass farmer. If you ask him, are you a rancher, a chicken farmer, an egg farmer? You know, he'll say, I'm a grass farmer. And when I got to the farm, he insisted, before I met any of his animals, that I get down on the ground and meet his grass. And he explained something very interesting as to what happens. As you know, he grows these six different animals in this very complex rotation. It's kind of an animal rotation based on manures and grubs and all this kind of stuff. And but what's happening, if we go really local, because I do want to talk about local food, and we go down to the level of the single grass plant in the pasture being grazed by the ruminant, before the chickens come in to fertilize that pasture, here's what's happening. That grass plant, which might be about this long, as soon as it is sheared by that ruminant, does something that all gardeners understand. It strives to restore its root-shoot ratio. It strives to balance the root mass with the leaf mass that it's lost. So it promptly sheds as much root as it has lost at the teeth of that cow. That's a very interesting process. Essentially, it's killing off its roots. And then what happens to those roots? Well, Paul Stamets's friends, the mycelium, go to work, along with the bacteria and the protozoa, and they break down those roots, and that is precisely how soil is made. We build soil from the bottom up, and that is how the prairies were made, in a reciprocal relationship between the bison and the grass and all the wilderness of life that takes place in the earth's stomach, the soil. Joel adds to this kind of pulsing of the pasture the element of bringing in the chickens to add nitrogen to it, and within 6 weeks, the grass is back, and he can run it again. And the key thing to know here is that at the end of the year, he has taken off an immense amount of animal protein from this farm. 40,000 pounds of beef, 30,000 pounds of pork, 10,000 broilers, 1,200 turkeys, 1,000 rabbits, 35,000 dozen eggs from 100 acres. If anyone says, can organic feed the world? Take them to this farm. There is no question that sustainable ag can feed the world when it is done right. But the important thing to remember, I'm going to step on your applause, because the really important thing to remember is that at the end of that year, when all that food has come off this land, there is more soil, not less. There is more biodiversity, not less. There is more fertility, not less. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because most of us carry in our heads a model of our relationship to nature that is zero sum. That is, for us to get what we want from nature, whether it is oil, energy, whether it is food, whether it is entertainment, nature is diminished. We assume this to be true. We see examples of it all around. What that farm, what a well-managed pasture shows is that it is not necessarily the case. There is a non-zero-sum way for us to engage with the natural world. And for me, that is one of the most hopeful things I've observed in 25 years about writing about the human relationship with nature. So I don't have time to go through my whole Paris Hilton adventure. I worked on the farm as a farmhand for a week, and it was a brutally difficult week. I want to go right to some of the lessons that came out of this. Because in challenging this zero-sum idea, it's not just about our relationship to nature, it is also challenging our zero-sum attitude toward economics. And I want to move to economics and politics and put forth the proposition that some of the most important politics going on in this country today are being transacted at farmers' markets. There is a direct line from the kind of healthy soils underneath Joel Salatin's farm and other farms like his to, as Albert Howard reminded us a long time ago, a link from those healthy soils to healthy plants, to healthy animals, to healthy eaters, and healthy economies. I think local food is one of the most important political movements going on. It is much bigger than food. It is the most important protest against what Wendell Berry has called the rise of the total economy. The total economy is the globalized world in which everything is a commodity. Everything is produced wherever it can be produced most cheaply, which is to say most destructively of people and resources, and moved to wherever it can be sold most dearly. This is zero-sum food economy. It means more cheap food for us, less for the soil, less for the workers, and much less for the animals. Make no mistake, under this regime, and this is the regime of free trade and food that we're hearing is so important, food is about to go the way of clothing, of consumer electronics. Our food, in the vision of the globalizers, in the vision of the total economy, will come from wherever in the world it can be produced most cheaply, freeing American labor and land for higher uses. I frankly don't know what higher use there is for labor and land than growing food, but in the views of the economists, people like Stephen Blank at UC Davis, Americans farming is like PhDs doing child's play. This is the technocratic vision. Now, make no mistake, organic food is on the same path today. As organic food has gotten industrialized, we find a product such as Stonyfield organic yogurt made from organic milk powder from New Zealand, strawberries from China, apple puree from Turkey, blueberries from Canada. We are finding now we're in the age of organic feedlots, organic factory farms. These were words that were never meant to be attached to one another. Local food economies are our best hope for checking the drift toward the total global economy. And with food is where these economies begin. A revolt is underway across this country, a revolt of small producers and consumers, and some of the most important politics today, as I said, are happening at the farmers' market. Now, we're told all this is very sentimental to go back to a local food economy, even reactionary. And surely there are reasons for buying local that might strike the unsentimental as a little soft-headed. We like the idea of keeping farmers and their wisdom in our communities. We like eating food in season, picked at the peak of its taste and nutritional value, the fact that you find no processed food, no high fructose corn syrup at the farmers' market. We like the idea of keeping land near us in production of food rather than houses and strip malls, defending the landscapes we love. We like what happens socially at the farmers market, which is quickly emerging as the new public square in this country. I mean, if you compare what happens in the aisles of the grocery store with the farmers market, think about what a world of difference that is. At the farmers market, country meets city. Children are introduced to where their food comes from. They learn often for the first time that a carrot is not a glossy orange bullet that comes in a plastic bag, but is actually a root How amazing. People politic, they have petitions, they schmooze. It's just an incredibly vibrant space. And I think we like how the Farmers Market, or CSA, lets us reconnect through these plants and animals and their farmers to the natural world. We've always looked to food for that connection, and food will always give us that connection. Even the Twinkie has its origins in the natural world. It's only obscured to us. Now, I am fully prepared to defend local food on those so-called sentimental grounds. But I would point out here that all those benefits suggest this is a non-zero-sum economic relationship or social relationship. This is a lot more is going on in that marketplace than the exchange of money for food. But let me move briefly onto another ground. Let me move onto their ground. Let me suggest that it is the globalizers of food who are the real sentimentalists, who are, as Wendell Berry says, acting on a faith without any justification. Very much like the Soviet communists, the last great destroyers of local food economies, they tell us we need to sacrifice things we like here and now, landscapes, relationships, local enterprises, for a promise of future prosperity, that we must break a few eggs to make an omelet. What could be more unrealistic, more soft-headed, than to propose we should destroy things we have now and love in the present for the uncertain prospect of some future benefit? Let me remind you that the Soviet Union founded precisely on the issue of food. Let's stick with the eggs. Let's not make this omelet. Let me suggest that there's nothing more hard-headed or realistic than building and defending local food economies. Indeed, to do so is a matter not of sentiment, but of critical importance to national security and public health. And let me quickly run through a couple reasons.
You're listening to KKCR, and this is an interview with author Michael Pollan.
Energy. The total economy depends on cheap energy, not to mention peace and no threat from terrorism, in order to move these goods from point of cheapest production to point of highest purchase. We will not reduce our dependence on foreign sources of energy or confront the issue of climate change without dealing with this industrial food system. This food system is consuming 17% of our fossil fuel. That's to grow the food with fossil fuel fertilizers, to use diesel on the farm, to use diesel to move the food, to process the food. You know the statistics. We're moving all the food 1,500 miles on average. By the way, supermarket organic food is moved even further today. You can buy tulips in Seattle, local tulips in Seattle, at Whole Foods, but in fact, they've been shipped down to a regional warehouse in California and then sent back to Seattle. This is the rationalization of our distribution system. There are people in Denmark eating American sugar cookies, and there are people in America eating Danish sugar cookies, and as the economist Herman Daly had said, it would be much more efficient for them to swap recipes. So, energy. One reason to buy local. Sovereignty is another. Do we really want to go down the path we have gone down with our energy with food? Do we really want to find ourselves in a position where all our grain is coming from South America, our produce from Mexico? The projections right now that are in this state of California, at the end of this century, there will be no more food production in the Central Valley. It will be houses and highways, wall to wall, mountain to mountain. Do we want to go down that path? Do we want to give away our food independence? National security. Our government knows better than we eaters the risks of a highly centralized food system. Tommy Thompson, when he left Department of Homeland Security in his last press conference, he said something very interesting. He said, "For the life of me, I cannot understand why the terrorists have not attacked our food supply, because it would be so easy to do. When all your hamburgers are being ground in the same factory, when all your salad is being washed in the same sink, it is a very precarious way to eat." This highly centralized food system is very vulnerable to contamination, both deliberate and accidental. And that brings me to the public health justification for local food. We've just had a horrifying illustration of the dangers of centralized food. 200 Americans were seriously sick, and 3 were killed by eating bagged spinach. What does that have to do with local food? Well, that product, there are 2 senses in which that product is a result of our industrial system. First, that bug, E. coli 0157H7, is a mutation of industrial feedlot agriculture. That's where that bug begins. You do not have that in grass-fed cattle. Second, that bug was able to be spread far and wide because you're taking food, spinach, from many, many farms, and you're washing it literally in a single sink in San Juan Bautista, California, and then you're sending it all over the country. This is not to say you couldn't get sick from eating spinach at your farmer's market, but you know what? If you did, nobody would hear about it because it wouldn't be a national story. It would be contained, the food chain, you would know who was responsible. The response to this, though, to this real threat, is going to be exactly wrong. Instead of seizing on this and the terrorist threat as a reason to decentralize our food supply, which would be, if there was any true concern for homeland security, exactly what the government would be endeavoring to do right now, we are bringing in more regulation and more technology. Progressive senators are proposing that we begin to regulate farms the way we regulate meat plants. And you know what that will mean. That will put small farms out of business. So that you see what happens. As industrial agriculture fails and sickens us, the solutions promote more industrialization of agriculture. And that's what we need to resist. We need to move in the other direction. They want to irradiate the food supply to keep us safe. I say we put our faith not in technology or regulation, but in relationships. Relationships with small farms. Now, it's very interesting. At my farmer's market, spinach was doing just fine during this outbreak. People sense these things. They sense that that buying food from someone they know, someone they trust, is okay. There may be some risk, but it is a manageable risk. And that is one of the reasons, I think, that farmers markets, CSAs, this is the fastest growing sector of the food system. The number of farmers markets has doubled twice in the last decade. The size of this new rising market slash revolt is unmeasurable. It's an underground economy. No one's paying taxes. And in a way, I take no position on that. In a way, it's much like the last days of Soviet agriculture, when 50% of the food supply was coming off of small gardens, small underground markets. People simply went around the big system, and people here are beginning to do the same thing. Now, I want to talk about your vote, 2 of your votes, to wrap up. It's true, when the government won't protect our land, our communities, our food supply, our economies, we have to do it ourselves. We have to step out of the foreordained paths and systems. We have to act as consumer slash citizens. We need a sense of what it means to be a consumer that is broader than the usual, that perceives being a consumer as a co-creator, a builder of food chains. And we can build a local food economy. We are building a local food economy simply by getting out of the supermarket, by growing our own food, by joining the CSA, and by shopping at the farmers market. All of this is important. We are voting with our forks, and it is a very important vote. But, and I'll leave you on this note, we also need to vote with our votes, because not all the changes we need can be driven by consumers. Some of them will have to come from government. Some of them will have to come from the change that only citizens can bring about. I want to say a word about the most boring topic in American politics, but possibly the most important, and that is the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill, understanding the Farm Bill, is the hardest intellectual work I did in the course of writing The Omnivore's Dilemma. It is really makes your head hurt. But it is the rules of the system, of the game that we all eat by. It is the reason we are in this fast food nation, because the Farm Bill decides that we're going to grow cheap corn and soybeans, which are not foods, which are raw materials for industrial food. The Farm Bill determines how hard it will be for a local meat processor to survive. The Farm Bill determines whether local or national foods will predominate. And none of us work on this issue. We leave it to the senator from Nebraska to negotiate with the senator from Iowa. We treat it as a parochial piece of legislation, and the odds are your legislators, your senators and representatives, are trading their votes on this bill for other things they want. Why can they do that? Why can they get away with that? Because they're not hearing from you that you care, that this bill setting these rules is so critical to the future. We need to move away from feedlot agriculture toward local animal agriculture, and that won't happen without changes in the Farm Bill. We need to move from subsidizing cheap grain to helping people produce real food locally. And all that, these rules need to be rewritten, and it's happening next year. So I would just say to you and leave you with this totally unglamorous message. Let your senators and representatives know you're paying attention and you care. Let them know that you understand that the Farm Bill is really a food bill. And it is our fight. And unless we take it to them, they're going to do the same thing again, and we are going to have more corn, more soybeans, more Smithfields, more Cargills, and less farmers markets. So please follow this fight and help to wage it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Vote with your forks and your votes. Thank you.
We sure hope you have been inspired today. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.